podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello. Welcome to episode 55 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Trevor Robinson. Trevor is one of the people, with his partner Al, behind one of those ads that is sent to kind of annoy you if you're creative. Not because it was bad in any way, but because it was really good. Because what would happen is you'd get a brief, and a client or an account team or whatever would say, can you give us a blank? And sometimes that blank is two words like Double Life or Cadbury's Gorilla. Sometimes it's one word like Surfer or Balls, or in this case, Tango. Can you give us a Tango? And obviously, to get a Tango, creatively, you might be able to get there, you might not, but you need the other circumstances to be there. You need someone to buy a Tango and then back you as you try and make it. And Trevor's story about how and why Tango was made includes him and his agency, Hal Henry, Children's Glory, and but also a client who wanted to make his name and wanted to do it via this the ad for Tango and did it. And so that helps as well. That aside, my big memory of what Trevor now did was pot noodle. God, there was some weird pot noodle stuff out there. Pencil winning stuff about a dog called Randy. It was weird. It made Hal Henry the interesting transgressive agency of the 90s that it was. But Trevor's also created his own agency / production company called Quiet Storm, which is still going 25 years later. How many agencies have lasted 25 years? How many people created a new company structure, by which I mean, hey, I'm going to do a hybrid where we will make your ads as well as write them. And I think people are trying to get as much slice of the pie as they can. And Trevor had that vision a long time ago, 25 years ago. So that's great. The third main pillar of, I think, having a chat with Trevor, there's a lot of talk of diversity right now. Trevor is diversity in a lot of ways. He's a black guy who came from a South London council estate. And by that, I mean, we don't really have as many non-middle class people as we used to in the industry. And I think that's a shame. And I think when you look at Trevor with his background and then Al with his background coming from Scotland and the alchemy that created, I think theirs is a really interesting illustration of why diversity in creativity can really be a good thing. Anyway, I had a lovely chat with him. He's got an OBE. Find out about all that stuff and more in my chat with Trevor. Cool. So I don't know if are we in it now? Should we talk? Is that cool?
Yeah. That's why I was getting
okay.
Al out the room.
We'll get it. Great.
And plus, I get really self-conscious when
that's cool.
I'm talking shite, and then people are like, it's kind of weird talking about yourself at times.
It is.
Well, some people do. Some people don't.
Some people love it. Exactly. Yeah.
I can't get enough. At last, I can talk about myself as much as no one's going to stop me.
That's what this whole hour or so is about. Please do. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks so much for making the time, and apologies again for screwing up the last scheduling. I'm not a very organized person, and that's.
No, listen, that was cool. And you sent the flowers, didn't you?
I did. Okay.
Jesus Christ, I don't think I've even sent flowers to my wife. I shouldn't really pull my finger out.
It was the least I could do.
Oh, man, it's very stylish. Very cool.
Well, I mean, it is great to talk to you. And what I normally do in terms of starting these things off is just asking you why and how you got into advertising in the first place. So I don't know if you want to give us a bit of background there.
Okay. Well, is it recording now?
It's recording now. I mean, I'll edit it later on, so I can take out some of the chat at the beginning. But
yeah. It'll also be crunching away in a Rivita dry up.
I couldn't hear the crunching. Yeah.
The best thing that you need in your life. But So when I started getting in advertising, I sort of came out of college, and it was really weird because when I was at college, I was obviously I didn't know what I wanted to be and do. I was there. Well, I did a very general course because I knew I wanted to do something in creativity, but I had in my head that I might be an animator or a fine artist or a court artist. I was for a while to just make some money, and it was quite interesting in a bit. But I think I went off kind of painting and doing stuff, because you spend a lot of time by yourself, and it just used to, I used to find the isolation really maddening. I just couldn't imagine the rest of the life, my life, you know, like a tortured artist in a big studio all by myself and just producing these very pompous works of art. I just couldn't, it didn't feel like fun. And then I kind of, I did quite well at college, but even though I didn't think I could possibly continually come up with fresh ideas every day, I just didn't know how, if that'd be possible, that somebody's brain can just constantly on tap, keep coming up with stuff and keep getting them rejected. It was bad enough being at college when your work gets rejected all the time and you have to stand up and talk about it. And I found that really like, ugh, I'm not sure if I'd imagine doing that. But I went for my first big interview when I was at college, and I had to, because for some reason I couldn't get a grant when I was at college, so I spent a lot of time doing double jobs like at Tesco's and various things, but I was still massively in debt of trying to do my exhibition and buy stuff and commute to college, so I needed to get a job, and there was a job for an animator in Cambridge somewhere, I can't remember, so obviously a million years ago before anybody was born, but I was like up for this job, and the other one was a below the line agency, advertising agency, and I knew how to design a bit, and I was a bit of all sorts and stuff, but I could design, illustrate and do typography, and so I was like quite excited about the idea that I can either be an animator or, and it was quite a pivotal crossroad experience, because I probably was more excited about the animator rather than I was about working as a designer or a graphic designer or anything to do with advertising. And in the end, I didn't get the animation job. I got the job at Salmon Pierce, and that's where I met my creative partner, Al, who we later on managed to get into the West End and do all the tango work and the pot noodle stuff.
So, which college was that?
That was Hounslow Borough College. It was the last one I went to, but I went to Chelsea and went to a place called Southend. But Hounslow was I think their forte was advertising.
Yeah.
And a lot of the teachers would be, you know, slamming DNAD on your desk like it was the Bible. And it was like, you know, you want to get in there and you want to be an ad man. And I was just like, I'm not sure if I really want to be an ad man. It didn't really cross my mind. I just wanted to do something where I could utilize the fact that, you know, I love creative work. And I thought for some reason in my head, I thought I would be, and I would be all right if I got a job as a, you know, comic illustrator or a fashion designer or something. I thought I'd do well because I thought I had a strong imagination, and I had a passion and a joy when I was doing anything like that as well. So it was something that I knew I really wanted to get into.
And what year are we talking about? What year did you leave college?
Oh God! It was over. Oh God, I got out when I was 21, and 2021, and I just couldn't wait to get out. God, what's that? The early 80s, isn't it? And so I can't give you the precise date, but it was, like I said, before most people were born. and it was like, I mean, like, to be honest, it's like I found a real excitement about advertising back then. I'm not sure if it's around now, because I remember when we used to do the work at Samuel and Pierce, which was anything but exciting, because we used to call it the elephant graveyard of admin, and all these guys would basically get a lot of money for doing not very much, and they were on the sort of like latter end of their careers, and I just jumped in there all excited about advertising, and but these guys used to pick up campaign and just go through it and slag everybody off and pass comments about all the work, but yet we were doing ads for pile brochures, you know, doing the leaflets for piles and stuff, and it was awful. And but at the same time, I stumbled across Tom Carty and Walter Campbell, who Tom was at the time used to be a postboy at Dorland's, and Walt just managed to get a job in the agency as well. But Walt used to was teamed up with somebody else, and at night time he would work on his portfolio with Tom, and they would work on fictitious ads to build their portfolio. And for some reason, they used to invite lots of people that were, most of them have gone on to do really good stuff as well. But we and Tom and Walt went on to eventually do one of the best advertising campaigns this country still, maybe the world, seen, which was the Guinness Surfer ad, and they did all that. And I used to meet them after work. So I'd work during the day, then go over to Dorland's, and at night time work on my portfolio of ideas. And Tom would used to act as creative director and slag off everything that we used to do, and he used to do crazy things like we'll come up with campaigns, and he would put his best ad underneath the desk of creatives that would work there that were getting paid lots of money, and he was going, "This is the best ad that's in this whole agency." And he was very proud of, you know, sticking it on ceilings and underneath things where people wouldn't know it was there, but he would. It was quite fun and obsessional in a weird way. And then, like that, it became like, wow, if I'm ever going to break into this, it'd be amazing. Break into this world where I'd get paid for a living to come up with ideas or bad ideas. And it was interesting time. And I spent a lot of time, to be honest, like over years on the dole trying to break in. Because at the time, you'd kind of... You would have to get a placement. Do you know what that is when you get a placement within the advertising agency?
Yeah.
And you'd be there for about a week and you'd leapfrog into different places. But for some reason, people never really liked giving, or we never got a placement, me and Al. So we'd always go up and show them our work, and then you'd get these. Because it's just been quite nice, but they just didn't like our work, or they thought it should be like this, and we kept changing our books to suit this creative, and you go and see another creative and they would go, no, don't do it like this, do it more like a Dorland's ad, or do it like a Ogilvy ad, or do it like a GGT ad. And it was all the big agencies back then that we just did the rounds, Sarchi's, and it was quite grueling and quite soul destroying at times. But looking back, at the same time, it was like one of the most enjoyable times, especially for me and Al, because we had the promise of, wow, if we can get into this world and what we can do. And just every interview we had, we thought, right, we're in. So it was at the same time, it was a bit soul-destroyed, but at the same time, full of promise and optimism.
That sounds really interesting. Yeah, I asked about the year, because I think there's very different contexts for the advertising industry around different times, and I think, you know, the 80s
around the time you had like those big kind of massive, like, ads used to be the things that kids used to talk about in the playgrounds, yeah, that people would get really excited, sometimes was more awe-inspiring than the TV programs. This is the days of Hamlet and the Guinness, the early Silk Cut ads and Benson and Edges ads, when they used to be able to put cigarette ads on TV. There were big lavish ads where they had people like Ridley Scott direct, and Alan Parker used to direct them, you know, so they were real good. They were like calling cards for these British directors that were breaking out. And at the time as well, England was seen as the best creative output of advertising, better than in America back then. In going through that period, it was like we were kind of, and it was there. We reshaped like brands. Brands became famous overnight because of some of the powerful ads that was going on. And that's like the difference of that and the digital age now. And I must say that the kind of people don't really have disrespect, and the clients now think it's a bit like being a photographer now must be terrible, because once upon a time, you know, you were the one with the magic lens and you were there, you know, and pointing your camera, and you had to go and, you know, work the film and, you know, eventually print it up, and you were in control. Now everybody's got a phone that can take pictures and Instagram, and they're getting constant gratification that they're good photographers or good ways of communicating things. So it's been undermined, the whole prestige of being a photographer. And I think the same thing has happened to advertising, because everybody thinks they can come up with an idea now. I think everybody has done, but even more so now, because people are making it on their phones, because they're constantly having a barrage of ideas coming at them, not just in ad form, but all straight. So everybody's become a real cynic, especially client side, to what consists of a great idea that can change brands. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be involved with campaigns from Tango to our latest Haribo stuff that I know has changed the fortune of that brand. And I know that the general public, might not be every single one is award-winning, not, but I think the general public has a feeling of warmth towards it and a feeling of kind of, I like whoever's done this. I like the brand, I like the product, and I would buy some more of that, as opposed to if I see another one of those ads, I will punch myself in the face.
That is a good point. Much I'd like to spend probably 5 hours talking about what going to Dorland's and hanging out with Tom and Walt is like. Let's just go from... I don't know what happened between there and Hal Henry. So do you want to give us a little timeline for that process?
So when eventually me and Al got a job, our first job was at TPWA, and Murray Partridge was our creative director. But Tom and Walter, who had just gotten a job there, I think they were just in a year in there, and they were the top team there. And Tom practically bludgeoned Murray Partridge into hiring us at TBWA, because that was the first time we got a placement. And in the time we did a placement, we managed to win some business and keep their EVN account. So me and Al, within the space of 2 weeks, did quite well. And I don't think Murray really liked the look of us, because we were quite unorthodox. I never really saw the problem, but I think Al, being a kind of being Scott, and me being you know, this black guy, you know, not long off a council estate and probably a bit rough around the edges, I think the likes of these Oxford grads and this world, I think we made people feel uncomfortable, maybe. I don't know. I really can't see it myself. Anyway, he didn't particularly want to give us a job, and he just gave one of my best friends now, Pat Holden, and boy's partner at the time was Bill Bungay, and they just got offered the job there, I think 2 weeks before. So we thought the likelihood of him taking on another team is not likely. But eventually he did take us on, because of Tom and that bludgeoning them, saying, look, you can't not give them a job after what they've done. Anyway, he gives us a job. And then we lasted there for about 2 years, we had a rocky relationship with Murray. Not so much that we did anything wrong, but I think he felt, because a lot of the teams there, if you can imagine, Tom Carty and Walter Campbell being incredible creative juggernauts, and me and Al were quite hungry, and Pat Holden now, who's gone on to be a film director, and Bill Bungay went on to work with Trevor Beattie. Like, at the same time, he had a lot of strong, driven, you know, quite almost punk-like creatives working there. We would work through the night, we'd be playing football in the reception area, and I think he felt a little bit like, I don't really like these people. And when he got his chance to get rid of Tom Carty and Walter, within a space of a month, I knew we'd get fired as well. Al, my creative partner at the time, just didn't see it coming. It was just like, why would he do that? We've been doing great work, we've won business for them. And I was saying, look, if he's got the courage to get rid of Tom Walter, he will definitely get rid of us, which he did do. And then me and Al were back on the dole again. We lost a lot of... what was quite interesting was a lot of the creatives that we'd met in that time, really just, and we, some of them, we actually helped them get in the door and get a job. Soon as we were put on the dole, that, you know, literally a lot of them just turned their backs on us, wouldn't answer our phone calls and stuff like that. Now, ironically, they all, like, and when we joined Hal Henry, they all came running back trying to be our friends and all that. It's a very, that it's very easy for people to drop a shoulder in advertising. So if you're in trouble, it's not a great place to think you'll get that much of a helping hand. There's not many Tom and Warts in this industry. So we spend another month, a year or so on the dough trying to get in. And then we eventually got in at Hal Henry, where we went on to do some of our most striking work. And then when we got there, it was quite an intimidating place, because it was like a hot agency, and they were very much, like I said, that kind of era of fingers up to the industry. Our bosses and the setup, the planners, the whole system was a little bit anti-advertising and anti-industry. And like, our creative directors were the top creatives at the time, award-winning creatives. And even as we was about to get a job, the Maxwell tapes had just gone out on air. I'm not sure if you ever remember
The Israelites.
Fantastic commercials. The Israelites and all that. And me and Al knew we're going to that agency, and we were like, God, we're going to have to do something as good as, if not better than that, if we're going to keep our jobs and not get fired again. So it was quite, and we were very competitive with ourselves, because we just knew we had to do something that's going to be memorable and people would talk about. And it would force them to realise how good we are. And so it was, but we knew we had to. I always remember years ago when I was back at TBWN, and Tom, we were in the toilet, funny enough, and we were like having a pee, and he said to me, you know, what do you want to do in advertising? And I think I must have spluttered something that I want to do, something that people talk about and people remember, and, you know, and I'm proud of my family now. And he turned around and goes, well, you haven't done it, have you? And he just walked off quite angrily. But in his way, that was a pep talk to pull your finger out. And if you're gonna succeed in this industry, you've got to get people remembering what you're all about. Because, you know, they're just, it's not like, I don't think it's a particularly racist or bias or, you know, I think people just, you need to, it's a really kind of, unless you're shining, unless you're making money for people, you know, you're out the door. So you just really got to do that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was at college in the mid-90s, and Hal Henry had this reputation, probably because of a lot of the work you did, of being like, you know, this kind of crazy place where anything went. And it was like, you know, you didn't just do an ad. You could like write your ad on a pig and chuck it in Trafalgar Square, and that was the way to do the ad instead.
And, that's hilarious.
You wouldn't do anything like conventional. So do you think Steve, I don't know if it was Steve and Axel or what it was, what they saw in you as fitting what they were going to do going forward with that agency?
Well, I think, you know, I think even Steve and Axe, because we were up against a female team for our position at the desk, and we managed to fend off all those people and get our position. So we always had the impression there's somebody waiting at the door, willing and ready to take our seat at the table. So you had to really prove yourself. In terms of being unorthodox, I guess we always felt that it wasn't like we did, for instance, a Pepe ad years ago that went from being a really simple idea, from being an extremely bad idea and badly executed, where we went from, it was all about basically that capturing that moment when you have hysterics for no reason. We've all had it. We just can't stop laughing. And you have that joy between your friends, and you can't even remember what you're laughing about. And it was designed to be a really up commercial where you feel good and you kind of go, thank you, Pepe, for bringing that. You've tapped into my, and a very unpretentious kind of, you know, brought to you, you know, and it's just a bunch of people having a laugh wearing some jeans, and it was not meant to be highbrow or anything more important than that. And it was, we showed a reference to that, which was, I think, was in a film called Betty Blue, when these guys are just smashing tequilas and just laughing. And it felt like instantly you wanted to be there and you wanted to have that feeling. And, you know, anyway, we ended up showing it to them, and it was addictive of the time. The agency said, yeah, but we need to be bigger than that. It needs to be stronger than that. We need to have a line that's forceful and lots of line. And it was, I think the line was, Pepe, because one day you will die, was the, the strap line of, you know, that kind of extreme, have a laugh today or you'll be dead soon. And then it was, we couldn't just have a simple director to do it. We needed to have a maverick director that could bring it to life. This was our fault as well, but at the time the comic strip was really brilliant and we really wanted to work with the main director on that, but he didn't want to do it or couldn't do it or whatever. And then we went with sort of like an unknown quantity, which was Keith Allen, and which it turned out to be, no disrespect to Keith, but a big mistake for us because Keith was a bit of a loose cannon in himself. Yeah. And then we trying to do a very simple idea, and it was like, it's one of those times where, especially after seeing the first cuts, I really felt, oh shit, we're going to be put on the dole again, we're going to get fired for this, because it was just pretty awful. And and it was just like, we didn't lip sync. There was no personal mics on people, so what you had was a group cackle, and like I think Keith insisted on us going with 15 people, and it was only meant to be two people, maybe three at the most, having this intimate laughter. It ended up being this huge group of people in the park, just squealing like it sounded like animals in a cage, just squealing, and it had no start, middle, end. It was awful, and it just sort of went, because one day you'll die, and it was just like, I remember seeing it in the cinema. And I felt like hiding underneath the cinema. It was complete silent, penny dropping, and people just going, what the hell was that? And I think that was the bad part of being a Hal Henry. But the good part of being a Hal Henry is doing all the tango work, and even on Apple Tango was the opposite of being, which is also very addictive. And you can see how people's egos and people's head, you know, you can get, you know, ahead of yourself and just kind of stop realizing you just work in ads, mate. But the opposite side to that is to be in a cinema and seeing our Aqua Tango work up there, and people just in absolute hysterics and laughing about your work. And you can, it is one of those industry where if things are going great for you, you can lose perspective on yourself, and your ego can get a little bit flipped out of control, I think, because everybody's walking around thinking that you're great, and you think you're great, and being told that you're great, and you're getting paid a lot of money, and people love you for a while. So it's kind of very different when you run your own agency from when you're a young creative team, as me and Al were.
Just to go back into, I think everyone would love to know the story from as much detail as possible of how Tango came about, because it was such an iconic ad at the time, and it was what you wanted, I'm assuming, to be famous in all the playgrounds and win the award. So it was a perfect ad in that sense. So how did the brief come about? How how did the brief come about to you? How was it presented to you, and then how did you tackle it?
I think what it was the client, actually. It was Brickfit, and he walked in, and this guy, you knew, because there's some clients even now, no matter what you do for them, they will never buy a tango. They'll say, I've had clients come up to me and go, give me a tango.
Yep.
And as soon as you give it to them, they literally leap out the window and go, no way, can you give us something safe? And a bit like something that I've seen already, can you give me that? And so you end up, because it has to be, it has to emanate from the product itself, and it has to be true. And you, also, you have to, there has to be something that clicks between you and your partner, or whoever's coming up with the idea. And when me and Al knew, we had a real, and like Stephen Axe had divvied up all the different campaigns for various people on it, and everybody was working it, all every creative team was working on to win this business. And Al and I got the Tango one, and we came up with this idea that I knew, and Al knew, it was really strong, because it has our creative directors laughing their heads off, and then laughed as much as when me and Al came out with it, we were pissing ourselves laughing, and we'd started off and it was ludicrous kind of anti-advertising, because at the time it used to be these cause and effects advertising, probably still around, when you drink something and something really pleasant happens, or you put the perfume on the aftershave and all the women come running at you. What we were thinking of, when you interact with a product, something really horrible happens to you, and something that's not that pleasant happens to you. But not only that, it's got these invisible guys in the commentary box who makes comments on, did you see that? And at the time, it was, they still do it now. It's gone even more crazy now. But at the time, football analysis, just talking about the same old thing, and people would just, you know, be so animated and excited about some crappy little goal that's happened. We just like love that juxtaposition of something. A little bit crap happens, but they think it's the most the best thing ever. And we kind of, you know, when you're kicking around an idea, we were like, literally, we're thinking that the guy has a drink and somebody comes up and gives him a really big old kick up the arse, and it's not pleasant, and he looks like he's been raped or something, and it's kind of like, and we thought that was going to be hilarious. Obviously, we could never get that on air, so it ended up being the sort of Morecambe and Wise slap on the face, and even that, when me and Al was obsessing about how we could make this, and the director, I think, was a bit, Matt Forrest, who's an excellent, amazing director, kind of was the first one to put a camera in our hands or in my hand and said, look, mate, you guys have got your viewpoint on how this should be shot. This is before we shot it. Why don't you go on the park, just you know, shoot it roughly on the park so you can get a feeling of what you're trying to say to me. And me and Al went to the park, and when we did the little Morecambe Wise slap, it just looked pathetic and a bit rubbish. So that's where we started really doing the arms outstretched. And it's a big old slap. And then we were insisting on it had to be a big guy doing it that could cause you damage. So that's when the big orange man, I think it was the genie at first, and then it became, then it just became a big fat bloke in a nappy running up and down. So it kind of metamorphosized into what it eventually was. But it kind of started from me and Al just in our little office, just laughing our heads off. And I think you just kind of, in your head, you think, if this gets out there in its pure form, this will be famous. And this will not be like any other ad that we've seen on air. And I think it was the day we made it and we kind of got Gil Scott-Heron to do the voiceover, which was terrifying to me because Gil Scott-Heron is obviously a famous jazz guy that's no longer with us. It's just like a legend to me. And we were trying to think about how do we do the voice on this? And then we were at a concert, saw Gil Scott-Heron, and his voice was just, even when he was just talking, he could talk about going to the toilet and it would sound super cool. Do you know what I mean? It was like, yeah, man. He just had the voice. So it made complete sense to get him to do, When You Know You've Been Tango, Strapline. And then we showed it to him when we were playing him, and I felt it quite intimidating. He's an American guy, and I was thinking he's just going to look at these, what are these dumbass limeys doing for a commercial? And he pissed himself looking at it and laughing about it. And I was like, my God, Gil Scott-Heron's laughing at our commercial. And he's like, and he was really pumped about it and psyched about it. So I think that was the time, and I think the week just before it kind of happened, I said to Al, this is going to make us. And that's when, you know, for the first time, I felt like, right, we're not going to get fired within the next 5 years. Do you know what I mean? So we're going to be, this is going to keep us on that particular wave. And I remember just being on a train going up to see my son, who used to live miles away in Hounslow, and just being on the train and seeing, half asleep on a train and hearing these guys just joking about our ad. And I was just like, and I woke up to have them talk, you know, and I thought they were talking to me. And I sort of like said to, I really want to say to them, oh, we did that, or I did that. Do you know what I mean? And I remember thinking they would have thought, who is this crazy black guy half asleep on the train claiming to have done something? But it was a pivotal moment for us in our career.
And what about when it got banned and all that sort of stuff? How was that? Did that make it bigger for you?
I think it did. I think it really, because they asked us to, because I thought, shit, we are going to lose our job now. Because we didn't, obviously it wasn't our intention that people were going to run around slapping each other like the commercials. And you know, we had young doctors complaining to us about perforated eardrums because they were doing it to each other. The doctors were doing it to each other. Then they're saying, look, you do realise people get perforated eardrums. So, like, it was our intention to force these doctors to start whacking each other. And then we kind of was a bit devastated when we found out that the ad was going to get pulled. And then we was like, and I think it's a good thing with our creative directors as well, made us feel like, right, this is not a disaster. We had to do these ads, a remake of the ads where the guy the fat guy runs up and gives him a kiss. So we came up with this idea to still run the ad, but instead of smacking him, he runs up and gives him a kiss. So it was this kind of ironic wink to the audience as well, because they all knew this had to be changed. And then rather than just showing a completely new ad, we just did the same ad. I think it's the first time it was ever done, where you just change it blatantly. Change the most controversial scene for something that wasn't very controversial, but still in its own way was a life to the homophobics out there. They were a bit kind of like, whoa, he just ran up and kissed him. So it was quite a good time, because, and I think like any person, I like to believe I'm like that as a creative director, where you get behind an idea and you kind of I think it's important that the creators really believe that they've got your backing, and that you're not going to sell them out, or, oh, it didn't work out. So, you know, which I always felt in advertising, that any minute now you're going to get stabbed in the back by anyone. And until obviously running your own, you'd just be stabbing yourself in the back, you'd be fine.
And if you're at that sort of peak and sort of pinnacle, was there a pressure? Did you feel to like follow it up with something just as good or anything like that?
I think there's always a pressure, but you put that pressure on yourself. And I think it's like I said earlier, it's not so much as a pressure from the industry, which there's a lot. I remember even when me and Al was just like a year after that, I remember this guy, a new account guy, comes in, he was telling everybody that we're burnt out. And we, you know, whenever he came around, about, you know, in the mid-20s or something, in truth, he was like, so there's always those kind of people walking around. But I think, especially when me and Al said, and you could feel it now, we never did ads particularly because we were never that clever to go, right, now we've got a brief, let's do something that's going to rip everybody's faces off. I think it's still now, if we could do something that pleases us and makes us laugh or makes us think or makes us like, oh my God, if we get to make that, if we get this past the client, if we get this in the world, it will have an impact. As soon as you have that feeling, I think you don't really worry about, are you going to do it again? Is this going to be, you know what I mean? You just get on with it. And I think I've been very, really lucky like that through, you know, you'd be really lucky. I've been really lucky to of knowing when we come up with something, this is going to create impact. And also, we've been incredibly fortunate when we were younger to have, a creative directors that not only could recognise a good idea, would fight for it, would help us. We didn't even come up with a strap line. That was our creative director, Steve Henry, who came up with that strap line. Because I just didn't care about the line. I just cared about getting this idea out there. And I thought, and they would turn around and go, well, we need a line for that. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it wasn't the most important thing, but it's one of the things that people still remember the line. It's important that not only did we get our foot in the door, but we had a massive amount of help by having a client who wanted to be scared, who wanted to be famous, who wanted to take on Coke and wasn't as scared to do that, wanted to be famous so he could get a bigger, better job elsewhere as well. And he was unashamed about this, because you guys are going to help me get to that top of the ladder. And it did do it for him. And I think that's when I really realised how powerful advertising can be, not only what it was doing for clients, did for our career, but how it rippled and affected the general public out there. People still walk up to me and they talk about, oh, bloody hell, I remember being at school and doing that and da da da. You go, there's not many people, that's why I'm quite proud of it still. I don't, some people go, oh God, don't you get sick and tired of talking about it. But I think, well, how many people have, and I've got a mate who's boasting to me that he's won 7 things that can. I couldn't tell you one idea that he'd done, one campaign, that it didn't. If I said it to you, I think you'd struggle to remember one of those ideas. And I just think I'm really lucky that Al and I have created something that really does. It's sort of like, you know, people haven't really forgotten once seen it. They haven't really forgotten it. And we was also told it was one of those campaigns that kind of changed advertising, which I would never be as cocky to suggest that, but that's nice to know, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And what's interesting, I think, is that even though you had a great client there and you made a piece of work that was a bit kind of on the edge. To me, pot noodle is even weirder. So what about, what? How did that come about? Because it's even more transgressive in a lot of ways with the me and my dog and all this kind of stuff. So
yeah. I mean, all that stuff. I mean, we were at that stage as well. A lot of the stuff that we watch and obviously are consumed by ends up coming out in your work without you knowing it. And you kind of, so like I said about the commentators, on that really came about me and Al watching American football, and football with commentators just obsessing over the sport and just talking crap about it and being overly crazy, and like that from the ones in Brazil or the commentators that would just go nuts. So we really wanted to have that energy in the work. And like in the same way, what we were really influenced was a lot of the alternative comedy acts and coming up on TV, and it was, we wanted to get that energy into the pot noodles, and we wanted it to be like, this stuff is throwaway, but it's for this moment, this 30 seconds I'm eating it, I'm going to devour it, and I want stimulating things to watch while I devour. So it was really kind of like, it was brazenly saying that this stuff is crap, we know, but at the same time, it's brilliant. It's like that kind of eating a kebab in the rain when you're in the right mood and you're a bit drunk, and you're staggering home, and it's the best meal ever. Do you know what I mean? So we really wanted to give it that importance and make that, and capture that spirit, that kind of, this is not Jamie Oliver gourmet meals here. This is all about pot noodles, throwaway, but intense flavor, intense taste. You need to watch intense films. You need to watch this. And like, and we went later on, went on to really pushing that this stuff is rubbish, and we know it's rubbish, but you love it. You can't get enough of it. That obsessional thing. So it was a curve from when we started it there, which was for us. I think it being so long on the dole, you end up thinking like planners as well, because you end up thinking of like the target audience and what is their relationship with the product, what's their honest relationship with the product, and what can it be? And like trying to say you will be cool because you eat this product and saying cool a lot, you immediately aren't cool, and you immediately, your audience knows that, and your audience thinks it's the opposite. And I've seen a lot of work that's gone out there, and people think because they've art directed, used all the best and been incredibly stylish, and they feel like that's enough, people are going to buy into that, people aren't stupid, and then people get just as bored seeing glossy ads that mean nothing, that's just obviously trying to sell me something. And then I think what Al and I really got the essence of, and which has helped us in our own career, was we really understand the people that's buying this. Like my brother would often say to me quite deliberately, did you just do that commercial? And he knew I hadn't done it. And I would kind of go, no, I haven't done it. He goes, what have you done recently then? Do you know what I mean? It's that Tom Carty kind of mentality out there that people have of like, actually, if you don't grab my attention, if you don't make me emotionally feel something about this, you can shove off, you waste my time. And I don't have time to be wasted. And I want to be entertained every moment. And if you think about that, you've got 30 seconds to entertain people and to make them like you, like your brand, like what, you know, you've got to do it. You can't waste people's time or money doing that. And I feel I got to try and deliver that. That's what I'm trying to deliver all the time, to be honest, rather than trying to do another tango. I think you're trying to make sure we deliver, you know, real, put our money where our mouth is for our clients and make sure they walk away and going, like, you know, that affected my book. People remember the brand. You know, you don't, how many times have you seen an ad on the TV and you're describing it to someone, they go, what's the brand name? And you go, I don't know what it was, but, you know, this happened. And that, for me, is what I'd like to believe. That's never happened. Even if you hate the ads that I've done, people remember the name of the brand. And I think that's what, you know, people don't go, have you seen a, people talking like, they go, have you seen a Haribo ad? And that's what I love about what we do. We've just done a Vimto commercial, and people are talking about Vimto. And that's the whole reason to be in this industry, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really interesting, because a lot of what you've said so far is like, you know, you're a black guy from Council Estate, you've got a Scottish guy working with you, you like alternative comedy or football commentary or whatever. And when we talk about diversity these days, to me, there's a diversity of background that isn't necessarily related to anyone's race or gender or sexual orientation. But you're talking about a really interesting mix of you and Al there, where what you came up with was some really interesting stuff. And I think that we're homogenizing the number of people going into the industry these days.
I totally agree.
And what you brought with your diverse background, whether it's on the surface or otherwise, was what created the really great advertising. So I don't know how you feel about that and how things were at that time, but you know, do you think things have changed a lot in that way?
Well, I can't really, because if I'm honest, I've been running my own place for almost 25 years, so I haven't really been out in the world that much. When me and Al were going around on the dole, we'd go to lots of agencies, you could really get a taste of what that agency was all about. And I can't really put a hand on my heart. I do know when I go to award dues and stuff like that, I look out and in some ways I see less black people and less ethnic people in the room, which really disheartens me. I do see more women, which is great, but I feel a little bit sad that we're not breaking in. And I think really what it is that people just, they don't see how important it is for those exact reasons you've just said, in terms of the clash, the different in spirit between me and Al, but the same, that kind of energy, that kind of spark, that so therefore something new and in some ways frightening comes out. That's no longer there. It's like it's being produced by people, and they look for people like themselves. They look for the protege that is just like them when they were young and coming in the industry. They don't want to see the funny-looking black guy in the reception area with a massive portfolio trying to get in the door. I think they find it stressful, and they find it like they don't see how important it is for the business. And I really do think a lot of the terrible advertising that you see around nowadays and the boring, bland advertising is because it's written by boring, bland people. And they don't know they're boring and bland. They don't, you know, they actually think they're quiet. And but they are the people that, you know, invariably, if you sat at a dinner table, if you would just want to move or top yourself. So I think that's the nature of what's coming out of this industry. It's like people are looking for, as I think Dave Bonagrini calls it, people trying to polish these Fabergé eggs to create this beautiful piece of art, but not so much about having something that's really going to move your mum to purchase this product or even to talk to their friends about it. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's that kind of distance from the target audience is there as well. It's not a true representation. If you look at most Western agencies, they're all from London, they've all been Oxford grads, they've all been, you know, well-educated. And like, most of the population isn't like that. Most of the population do, you know, watch, you know, they watch reality TV, they watch, you know, a lot of the stuff that these guys will be turning their nose up at. They just wouldn't, you know, a lot of them don't have Netflix and all these different various platforms to watch. They have the conveyor belt of normal TV that's out there. And I think that's the problem. If you don't, I think what I used to love about what happened to the cigarette industry and for the creativity, it forced everybody to be really creative about it, because you're no longer just to go have a cigarette. It's great. Do you know what I mean? You weren't legally, you weren't able to say that. So there was this coming down on the destruction of the industry, but near the end, they were creating these the most amazing ads because they were pushed in a corner. What can we say when we can't say anything? You know, and it made people really think outside the box. And I think that's what happens when you have a clash of personalities, when you have people that aren't coming from your industry. You do find yourself thinking like in a different way. And like, you know, I think it's so important that, you know, and I think I definitely feel I love working with younger people and people from different backgrounds for me and stuff, because I just find myself in a completely different road that I would never go down. I would never have thought of going down. And I think that's what's brilliant about when you work with a good creative partner like Al. A guy's a genius and he can come up with stuff that would have me pissing. Like, a couple of times we've just sat in this office just laughing our heads off, you know. And I love that feeling where you can escalate an idea from this little thing here to being up there that will really, you know, if anybody else comes anywhere near that, they will be affected by it. So I think for me it's really important when you mix it up, you make the you make not just the ideas just doesn't come out of nowhere. You gotta mix up the room. You know, just having a brainstorm with yourself is not going to be that interesting.
Absolutely. So just go back to your career. So was Quiet Storm something that you went into from Hal Henry? Was there anything between?
No, it was. It went straight into it, and it was kind of odd because I never ever woke up or had a dream about running my own agency. It was not something that I wanted to do. All I really wanted to do was write and direct, and at the time, it was just seemed like a mad, massively mental thing to do. It's like you were either a copywriter or an art director, and you were happy to do so and be that person. And if you wanted to direct, you would give up working in advertising and totter off and say, right, I'm now a director, and you go night school and work to be a director and go down that road. And no one ever did both. No one, which to the life of me, I couldn't understand why. And there was a couple of people in the States and a guy in Amsterdam that was doing both and had agencies. And I looked at their work and went, oh, I want to do that. And then we sort of like said it to our bosses at the time. And it just went around, and I can't remember why, if it was them or it was us, it didn't happen. And that's all I wanted. If they gave me a job where I could direct my own work, I would have been happy as Larry. But it turned out that myself and Al, my ex-wife, who was an accountant and our own producer, got together and said, let's do our own agency. And at the time, my ex-wife was just being let go at Hal Henry, so she was a free agent and wanted to do it. And Jane, who really wanted us to be creatives at her place, directors at her place, and didn't really care, and I didn't realise it at the time, didn't really care about the whole notion of being a creative and creating this new hybrid agency. But we left there quite naively, without any clients at all. So Hal Henry still let us do some of the Apple Triangle, but other than that, we had no accounts, so it was also incredibly stupid and naive. And I just at that time as well thought people come running down the street going, oh, you guys did the tango work, so here's our business. And obviously, it wasn't like that, and it was like, and Al kind of felt really uncomfortable about all that and left and went back. And Jane turned around and said, I don't want to lose my name, so you can have the office space, but I don't want to do it anymore. And so I was just left holding the baby with me and my ex-wife, who was on the accountant side. And somehow, if it happened now, I don't think I could have done it. But at the time, I had so much self-belief and feelings that we could be successful and stuff like that. So amazingly, we continued to create an agency. And I think it was just me, a receptionist, and my ex-wife. And then it gradually built it to the company that's gone up and down through the years, but it's still here and still, in my opinion, doing great work. But it was not something, like I said, that I had a dream about to do. And it's not something that I ever, ego-wise, wanted to do. But, I mean, in hindsight, especially now, being in control of your own destiny is amazing. And being able to forge some really long-term, some of our clients over a decade, I've been working with them. So that's amazing to be in that position. And also to see and work with the young, talented people that I've had fortune of come through this place. And, you know, even the bad times and the recessions and the Brexit's being thrown at us as a company, we're still here. So it's kind of, it's. I feel very fortunate, you know, especially, you know, when you know the reality of people and their jobs that they had to, that they've had to do all their lives and have to, you know, suck up to people and laugh at bosses' jokes and, you know, and kind of like just not want to get out of bed in the morning, but you know you've got to do it to pay the mortgage. So I've been incredibly lucky to have stumbled into my career.
Yeah, I think a lot of creatives who haven't, say, started an agency or got involved to that degree have missed out on knowing a lot of what happens in advertising, like why these things are important or what really matters in terms of selling ads. It's not about CAN, it's not about D&AD, it's about actually transforming your client's business. And so I'm a little bit interested also in how you went from you and a receptionist and your ex-wife to how did you start getting clients? What did you have a plan, a pathway? What did you really want to do to get into that?
It's really true. trial and error, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember how we first really started it. I think we're a production company first and foremost. People wanted to work with me as a director. Right. God knows why, because I hadn't done anything. So, and I think we got lucky with winning some awards for a director, and it was in campaign. Ooh, what we did on Apple Tango, that was the first thing that we really did as Trevor Now or Quiet Storm, as it came in the end. And I thought that was a pivotal moment for me when it was like, but in terms of knowing, having a formula, how to pitch and stuff like that, that's an ongoing thing. And I think we've honed our skills a bit, like and you had to learn very quickly as well, because we were up against big agencies all the time. So it's like being a bullfighter, not being given, there's not much time you got as a novice, because you have to get in there and win that business. And we're sometimes up against agencies who had 40 creatives all working on the brief, you know what I mean? So you had to not really, and you know, we'd sometimes see them come in there into the reception area, and it'd be like they come marching in like the Gestapo with boards and presentations and planners and and all these people would just hoard in there, and they would just look at us and laugh. And like, it was such a high when you beat these people, do you know what I mean? When you won the business, because you knew you won it on merit, you wanted it on talent, and you won it on likability. That a lot of those people that I remember being in some weird situations where they had all the agencies having to do a kind of get to know you thing with a client, and sometimes I'd look across the table and think, well, you guys are slick and sharp, and you know how to talk, and and you look like what an ad person or ad man should be, but at the end of the day, I don't trust you and I don't like you. And I think if anything, that what we've always had was an element of connection with the client, and definitely a connection with the target audience. We know how to sell to them, and that's what I've always believed more than anything. I know those hard to get at teenagers, those cynical people that I grew up with, and I know, like, even when we worked on a campaign that I worked with these kids from my old school, really wanted to get them into the industry, but I also wanted to try and put a dent into knife and gun crime, and getting these kids to, who better to do an advertising campaign to them than to get the kids to do it? And that's what I did, rather than being done by these ad guys who do their nice little, trying to hopefully win an award by doing some charity thing. I thought, well, what I really want to do is get these kids who know how to talk to these people, who know how to communicate, get them to write the ads. It was like one of the best experiences I've ever had, to be honest. I know I'm no way very good at being a teacher or working with the younger people, because I just don't know how to do it. And I think I'm a bit obnoxious when it comes to doing like that. I just can't get why they don't understand what I'm saying. But in terms of the experience that I got out of it, in terms of the work, the media picked up on it. It was on the news. And I think it's probably the reason more than anything why they ended up giving me an OBE, was because of the work that I did with this charity thing that we created. But I think for me, it's always the thing that gives me the biggest thrill is really, honestly, powerfully cracking the brief by any means necessary, really, to do that. And I'm not ashamed to make mistakes, and especially now, I've noticed this with a lot of young teams, they're just terrified of doing something bad and getting in campaign and getting Turkey of the Week or their peers. I think it's this whole Facebook constantly people viewing what you do and what you say and making sure you word perfect and you don't come across as Trump, and it's just kind of like it's a very terrifying under a microscope kind of world out there, and it's really doubly so if you're creating a world. Like back in the day and still now, I just wanted to do things that me and Al would laugh about and talk about and want to see on air. and wasn't that worried about if some people would be offended by it or upset by it or do it or whatever, you know. And I think now people, that's why it's so many, I think, a lot of beige pieces of advertising out there, because not only are the people that are doing it quite beige, they're terrified to do anything that will really stand out, which seems horrendously weird when you're in a thing called advertising. You know, you should be doing stuff that's going to really advertise, really stand out, and force people to remember it, even if they see it once. Force people to remember it.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that the industry has changed a huge amount. In those 25-ish years that Quiet Storm has been going, there's been so much that's changed about advertising overall, and we touched on the digital stuff earlier and whatever, but you're still there. Do you think it's been by adhering to a set of core principles that you haven't changed, or by being flexible and adaptable so that you've been moving with the wind, or a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. I think definitely the latter as well, because we started off as a hybrid company anyway. Yeah. We were already, like, people were trying to do our role models, and a lot of these big ocean liners of agencies are trying to do our thing now because they want to do the production well, because they want to keep the money. They want to also do content. They want to do all that. Because we started doing that anyway. My creators were writing and directing, so they were on doing behind-the-scenes stuff. Some of the junior team would be shooting up behind the scenes. So we naturally started doing it. We weren't very good at advertising what we were doing, and a lot of other people have just come in and taken the high ground because they're big agencies, and they've been quite, they're smarter than us at advertising themselves. I've never been particularly brilliant at it, which ironically, I'm good at doing advertising, but I'm not very good at advertising myself. It's like what I was saying to you earlier about, you know, not being, being a bit embarrassed about advertising myself. I'm like, who really wants to do that? But I have forced myself to do a lot of stuff like this, and you know, get up on stage and talk to audience about, you know, things that I love about the industry, things I dislike about it. Even talking about diversity, you would have thought that's something that should be close to his heart. And then, but I just don't like hearing my own voice, and I don't like seeing myself on stage, and I really hate seeing things played back to me. I'm just thinking, who is this old black man just waffling on and on? And it's just like, I just believe everybody thinks the same way. So I have that screaming in my ear more than anything. But I know, and I've always forced myself to do stuff because the rewards are amazing. If I didn't force myself to sit in this office, like Paul Out, when we first started, he used to be the one that would do all the talking for me because I was petrified. I was petrified of saying the wrong word. I thought all these big, smart people do not want to hear a thing about that I've got to say, and if anything, they will turn around and go, whoa, wait a minute, this guy's not like us, we need to kick him out fast. And it was like, it was a real phobia I had about, and to this day, if I can force somebody else to say my idea, I will do, because I just find it very difficult.
But I think there's an element of, you know, if you see it, you can be it, and what I've tried to do in terms of having a podcast and giving a voice to some of the sort of people who've done some of the industry changing work in the past is to let people know in a time when I do think it's become a little bit more bland and homogenized, that how do you go about doing that stuff? And is it okay to be a quiet person and do that stuff? Is it okay to be a racial minority and do that stuff? Is it okay to have come up in a completely different time and do that stuff? And whether it's you I'm talking to or some of the other people, and everyone's got their own story. But if you've done great work, I think we need to get out there and show people that it can still be done, and you don't need to worry about being from, you know, this kind of person or this background or anything like that, and make your own path.
I think when I'm working even now, when I'm directing and when I'm doing stuff, I don't think about me. I'm just totally caught up in the work to the point that, you know, it's obsessional. You know, I find myself sometimes even being out with other people and I'm still in the work and I'm still trying to solve a brief when I'm asleep. You know, I'm editing when I'm sleeping. You know, I'm kind of like still, sometimes I get up and I write things down thinking it's the best idea that I've ever done and looked at it in a cool light and go, oh, that's pretty shite. But I think there's something that I've always been able to fall back on, because you know, from being able to paint somebody in a room and draw somebody, I was always couldn't wait to show it to that person, for them to give me that pat on the back or whatever. Like, that is me. That you've captured me. And I think that's what has made me overcome my insecurities, because I'm more excited about sharing the idea with people out there and seeing their reactions and knowing that that's us. We've done that. You know, we've taken this brand from being anonymous to being something that people are talking about down the pub. And that is, you know, or an issue that we managed to highlight that people hadn't even thought about before, you know. And it's kind of, that's, if I can do that for a brand, that, believe it or not, just makes me so happy. And that's what really has kept some longevity with me, especially because I always know there's so many different ways, if you're allowed, to really make a massive noise out there and get people talking about it. And that's nothing, like I said before, nothing more compelling than that to me.
Absolutely. Well, unless there are any other things you want to say, I mean, I just wanted to really say thanks for putting yourself out there for this conversation, because, you know, it's been a massive education, I think, not just in how you did the specific bits of work, but the principles you followed to still be doing it in the business with your own company, a company that started off in, you know, being unlike anyone else's company out there, but it's still going, which I think is incredible. So, I mean, I hope if anyone out there is going, you know, is it okay for me to do it this way or that way, in hearing the way you've gone about your life and career, that it is okay to do it this way and that way. And if you just make sure it's all done to a high enough standard, it will last and it will succeed. So,
yeah, huge, I mean, fun. Like, absolutely. If you told me that I would be still working in this industry at this point, I wouldn't believe you. So it's testament to, like, sticking by your guns and just keeping interested and excited about what you do, and being a bit shameless about what you do and brave about it. Even though I don't think I've been particularly brave, because we're just doing stuff that we want to see and do. But at the end of the day, some other people will say to me, "Wow, my God, what? How did you come up with that? How did you dare put that out there?" I'm just like, well, because, you know, it made us laugh. But I hope it's people find it inspiring and think, well, if that geek can do it, I definitely can do it. So I think that's the best thing that I can offer people, because they could go, well, it sounds a bit of a numpty, but he's done it.
Fantastic. Well, Trevor Robinson, OBE, you're the first person with an OBE that I think I've spoken to on this podcast, so I'm just going to say it. Huge thanks, and I don't know if you want to listen to it back, but I'll put it out at some point in the next week or so. And
what if you give it to Summer and Ron? They'll listen to it. I can't sound my own voice, and it would just sound like a lot of gibberish to me anyway. So, but I'm sure they would love to hear it. So if you don't mind making sure that they have a listen to it first.
Okay, thanks, Trevor, and have a great rest of the day.
You're a star, sir. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Cheers. All right. Bye.
Bye now. Bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?